Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to this seminar being hosted by the Global Health Initiative. My name is Justin Parkhurst. I'm an associate professor of global health policy here in the Department of Health Policy. I'm also the current steering committee chair for the Global Health Initiative, so a warm welcome to you. If you are not already a member of our mailing list, Nikki, what's our email address? Global Health?
Global Health at LSE.
So globalhealth@lse.ac.uk, and you can get our monthly newsletter, which has announcements about other events, speakers like this, and other things related to global health going on in and around the LSE. But it's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Ted Schrecker from the Institute of Health and Society, Newcastle University. Ted moved to the UK in 2013 from Canada, is that right? Originally at Durham University and now at Newcastle. His work really cuts across issues of global health, political economy, health inequalities, and their relationships to health. And so it's really nice that it's great he's come to talk to us. Many of the students in my social determinants of health course are here. Today our lecture was on inequalities in health, and so I greatly encourage them to attend this as well. He's also co-author of the book How Politics Makes Us Sick, Neoliberal Epidemics, which was published in 2015. And he serves as a co-editor of the Journal of Public Health. So, Ted, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that mercifully short introduction. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you all for coming out in the cold and rain. Just a few words of background. I am a political scientist by training, and I came rather late to the academic world with no formal background in health issues whatsoever, but a strong interest in processes of large-scale social change that started about 17 or 18 years ago. And actually, no, it now started 25 years ago. How time flies when you're having fun. So anyway, I came late to the academic world after more years and less money freelancing than I care to think about. And it was a long and winding road to the post I now have, which is that odd role of a social scientist teaching in a faculty of medical science, which, you know, creates some interesting tensions from time to time, which is why I feel I have to preface talks like this with a product label. And this is the product label. And, you know, I can go into some of those issues in response to questions if anyone is interested. I should also say, please feel free to raise a question or disagreement at any point during the talk, because this is not an hour-long talk, much less an hour and a half-long talk. So, you know, there'll be lots of time for questions at the end, but also lots of time for interactions during the presentation. Well, it's useful, I think, just to reflect briefly on the sheer scale of health inequalities worldwide, and also at smaller scales, and I'll be saying more later about the smaller scales. This is the number I use in teaching. Right? It really, you know, it's extraordinary for a woman, except in the most deprived circumstances imaginable, to die in pregnancy or childbirth in the UK. It is extraordinary, unfortunately, apart from the indigenous population in Canada and indeed throughout the high-income world. In the in sub-Saharan Africa, the world's poorest region, it's 1 in 36. Okay, so these are, you know, if you're a woman in sub-Saharan Africa, most especially if you're a poor woman in sub-Saharan Africa, these are not good odds. Now, many of us find, you know, the thing that keeps drawing us back to global health policy and politics, even when perhaps we should know better, is the sheer moral arbitrariness of this difference, right? The accident of birth determining whether you will have the odds in the first bullet point or the odds in the second. And there is a long debate, an ongoing debate in philosophy, about whether, why, and how much that moral arbitrariness matters. But that's another talk, which I'm not really qualified to give since I'm not a philosopher. A bit more background. As you will all know, grand challenges have now become part of the global health vocabulary, and in fact, to some degree, part of the broader global policy vocabulary. And one of the fundamental criticisms of the grand challenges trend in global health is the criticism that my friend and sometime collaborator Anne-Emmanuel Bern made in this article a number of years ago, that the grand challenges are fixated on technology. All right. I think, in fact, this critique is somewhat overstated. I have occasionally had interesting discussions with a few of my colleagues about this, because there are some things that medical technology does very, very well, like immunizing people against measles. And this is a graph out of The Economist a couple of years ago, and you can see that measles immunization is one of those technologies that works very well, or can work very well, even in extremely low-income, limited-resource settings. So you get these interesting trends in which Rwanda and Tanzania and Sri Lanka now have higher immunization rates than a number of high-income countries which no longer achieve herd immunity. So there are some things that technology does very, very well. There are other things that it doesn't do very well, and my focus here is going to be on that broad range of influences on health that cannot be vaccinated against. The influences that the Commission on Social Determinants of Health described this way a decade ago. So, for example, there is no vaccine against chronic undernutrition. Right? It is a topic and a determinant of ill health that has to be addressed in quite a different way. So, a couple of basic presumptions here. The first of them is that reducing health inequalities on whatever scale depends on making available the prerequisites for leading a healthy life. A couple of years after his commission's report came out, Sir Michael Marmot, who chaired that WHO commission, and colleagues wrote that it is hard to see how even ideologically driven commentators could think that having sufficient money to live on is irrelevant to health inequalities. Sir Michael is a perennial optimist, and this presumption is not uncontested. The year before they wrote that, a House of Commons committee said, "We receive no compelling evidence to suggest that anyone knows at present what changes in tax and benefit would be effective at lowering health inequalities." And they wrote that despite having heard evidence from both Sir Michael and Richard Wilkinson that some of us would consider quite compelling indeed. Right? And you know, the talk about standards of proof, how much evidence is enough and who decides, is another one that I won't be giving this evening. So, second presumption is that in a context of increasing inequality on multiple scales, a core political task in terms of reducing health inequalities is establishing, I'm inclined now to say restoring, the legitimacy of a rubric that Ron Labonte and I in the work that we did for that WHO commission called Rights, Regulation, and Redistribution. And I mentioned the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development report here simply to bring to your attention, if you didn't already know this, that there is, in fact, quite a detailed global policy blueprint developed by that UN agency for what they call a global New Deal, right? So on a global scale, it is even less credible than it was in the UK in 2009 to claim that nobody knows at present what will work. Now, some people would say that this emphasis is ultimately superfluous. So, for example, this is a diagram many of you will be familiar with called the Preston Curve, which simply plots life expectancy on the vertical axis against GDP per capita in constant dollars on the horizontal axis. So you get this fairly familiar phenomenon of strong returns to growth up until a threshold of somewhere around $10,000 US per capita in this case, 2010 dollars, and weaker returns beyond that. Now, so the argument here is that as countries grow, a lot of these problems will sort themselves out. And as medical technology and prevention practices improve, other problems will sort themselves out. So as the curve moves upward over time, that's essentially the therapy and prevention dividend, because GDP is constant, right? And the Preston curve generally does move upwards over time. So, you know, another part of this glass half full or more narrative is the World Bank's familiar claim that poverty is declining and, you know, growth will sort these issues out. Now, there are a few problems with that glass at least half full narrative. One is, as you can see from the graph, and these are the World Bank's own figures, until very recently, with some declines in extreme poverty in India, this was entirely a China story. In other words, for a couple of decades or more, everywhere, every time someone in China escaped extreme poverty, and there's no debating the extent to which China has reduced extreme poverty, someone else outside China fell into it. Again, this is up to about 2005, 2007, somewhere around there. Right. That's one problem with the narrative. Another problem is that this is what extreme poverty means. Right. This is another item from that same economist feature, and you know, to avoid boring those of you who are actually here to tears at the expense of those who are listening on podcast, I won't read this out, but the point is simply that this is not a very good set of prerequisites for a healthy life, right? 28% of the budget left over for other things beyond this, you know, quite meager nutritional package. If we look at less unrealistic estimates of what it actually means not to be extremely poor. These are several that were developed by Sanjay Reddy and a colleague. Jason Hickel has done very similar work, but he doesn't have any graphs that are this pretty. You get a very different picture emerging with the number of people who are living in extreme poverty worldwide actually increasing up until somewhere around the turn of the millennium and only very modest declines after that. This is probably familiar territory. The grand challenges I'm going to identify now may be less familiar, and I'm going to identify five of these, although they're not the only ones. I can think of at least a couple more. And once again, these all go back to that presumption that making the prerequisites for a healthy life available to all is a prerequisite for reducing health inequalities, right? And if you don't accept that, and for example, the Lancet Commission on Grand Convergence in 2035, I think it was, which was led by two former World Bank officials, didn't accept that proposition, then the narrative goes off in another direction. So, onward to the first grand challenge, which is the global reorganization of production. And The Economist talks about global supply chains connecting cheap workers on one side of the world with rich consumers on the other. Eduardo Galeano talked about globalization as a magic galleon that spirits factories away to poor countries. And as an aside, if people tell you that globalization is really too vexed or contentious or complex a category to be of much use, take that with a grain of salt, because you see here remarkable agreement on fundamental elements of globalization, or at least the global reorganization of production, across a very, very broad range of the political spectrum. Well, we know that it's not only many things contributed to this pattern, including the liberalized trade and investment environment over the last few decades, containerization, which is a much less well understood part of the story, such that now we have global supply chains dominated by transnational corporations, accounting for about 4/5 of world trade. This is one of the more familiar supply chains, the iPhone. This is actually an unusual one in that you have Chinese assembly, which, you know, you have Chinese assembly of almost everything these days, but you also have most of the rest of the supply chain, at least the manufacturing supply chain, based in high or upper middle income countries, right? The starting point of the supply chain is many of the starting points of the supply chain involving cobalt mining are in very, very poor countries. Right. Now, one of the things about this reorganization is that it gives the companies like Apple, at the top of the supply chain, that's Apple, that's the assembly, gives the companies at the top of the supply chain a tremendous amount of power. So, for example, in 2012, after one of many disastrous fatal fires in a Bangladeshi garment factory, the New York Times revealed that Walmart, which was one of the major customers, had blocked efforts to improve working conditions in the factory on financial grounds. And, you know, Walmart is a big enough customer that in a context like that, what Walmart says goes. But that's not actually the grand challenge I want to bring to your attention. The one I want to bring to your attention, remarkably poorly understood, is that the distributional conflicts that underpin the post-war settlement between labor and capital in most of the high-income world no longer can be contained and no longer need be resolved within national borders, right? The factory can get on the magic galleon, right? So the distributional politics have changed fundamentally, and that's why that's one of the reasons those settlements are now eroding. A couple of very parochial examples from my own Canadian experience. This is really a global problem. This is the first one. This is an auto parts, family-owned auto parts firm in a small town in southern Ontario, which in 1978 experienced an extraordinarily long and bitter strike in which its mostly female workforce finally, after literally months of heavily policed picketing, finally won a first contract from the manufacturer. And a decade later, after Mexico's post-1985 liberalization of foreign investment restrictions, the contract ran out and the company simply shut the site and relocated production to a site in Mexico where they could pay workers a fraction of what they were paying in Canada and still be comfortably above the prevailing wage level in Mexico. The Magic Galleon. This is a similarly parochial example from the same part of the world a few decades later. This is the now deserted factory that used to belong to a company called Electromotive Diesel, which was for decades quite a successful manufacturer of diesel locomotives, first as an independent company and then as a subsidiary of General Motors. And around the start of this decade, General Motors sold the factory to Caterpillar Equipment, which is another U.S.-based company with a notorious history of hardball labor relations. So Caterpillar tells the workers, when the contract is up, you can take a 50% pay cut, or we will move production to our site in Indiana, which by that point had become a right-to-work state in order to compete for manufacturing jobs. And a right-to-work state means that essentially unionization is impossible. Right. So the workers, the unionized workers said no. Predictably, Caterpillar closed the plant, moved production, and that's what it looked like a couple of years later. As far as I know, it still looks like that. And this was the aftermath, 8 months afterward. Only one in four of the displaced workers had found work, and only 68 out of 485 had found full-time work. Right. Marriages were crumbling and food bank use was climbing. And at that point, the trail goes a bit cold because the absolutely stellar reporter who was covering the story got reassigned to another beat. The Magic Galleon again. But these examples show us that, you know, global issues don't just involve people and countries far away. Right? They can affect power dynamics that influence social determinants of health quite close to home. So that's the first challenge. The second challenge is rising within country inequality. And as many of you will be aware, most of the world's poorest people no longer live in the world's poorest countries. This is largely a statistical artifact because it results from the fact that a few large countries with large numbers of poor people have grown enough so that, according to the conventional World Bank or United Nations categories, they're no longer low income. They're now lower middle income. Okay. The other part of the picture is the increase in extreme inequality, both within countries and on smaller scales, such as metropolitan areas. This is pervasive, and I'll give you just two examples. The first of these is from the northern England town of Stockton-on-Tees, where I lived until about 5 years ago. This chart needs a bit of explaining. This is male life expectancy by ward. Wards are quite small units in Stockton-on-Tees, a few thousand people each. And this is a percentage of, the other scale is percentage of population that is income deprived, which basically means these are households that have people of working age receiving benefits. It's a crude measure. But you can see that the percentage of income deprived households goes from almost zero to more than 45% across Stockton-on-Tees. And there's about a 17-year variation in average male life expectancy. The red bars are what make this comparison interesting. That's national average life expectancy in England. That's national average life expectancy in Tanzania. And you can see that the variation within Stockton-on-Tees, population 141,000, is considerably greater than that variation in national averages. Right. That's one example. This is another. This comes from a remarkable website called Unequal Scenes, put up by a South African photographer named Johnny Miller, who uses drones to take aerial photographs of extreme juxtapositions of wealth and poverty. This particular picture is from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. You know, note the nice houses with swimming pools on the right-hand side. But he has these from all over the world. Well, this is the optimistic view. And Andy Sumner has been making this argument in a variety of settings over the past several years. In the not-too-distant future, most of the world's poor will live in countries that do have the domestic financial scope to end at least extreme poverty. And he goes on to talk about poverty reduction becoming primarily a domestic issue, a matter of national distribution and national social contracts and political settlements between elites, middle classes, and the poor. Right. So the presumption here is that the political system, whatever it may be in the country in question, will create incentives for the people on the right-hand side of that diagram to share resources with the people on the left-hand side. Okay, that's the presumption. The less optimistic view is based on a process that Robert Reich, quite a long time ago, called the secession of the successful. This is a former secretary in the Clinton administration. And a voter in Arizona, which has very interesting politics, pointed out to a journalist almost a decade ago, people who have swimming pools don't need state parks. If you buy your books at Borders, which is a U.S. bookstore chain that was sort of the equivalent of Waterstones, you don't need K-12, kindergarten to 12th grade education. The people here, or at least those who vote, don't see the need for government. Okay. My sense is that that is increasingly the case in many places. Here's another U.S. example. This is a house in Tennessee, Nashville, objecting to a campaign to raise local taxes to pay for public transit. Well, you know, you can imagine that the people living in that house are not heavily reliant on public transit. And in the event, the resistance to the local ballot initiative to raise taxes for transit, which was heavily financed by the Koch brothers, was not successful. Okay. So, you know, on the one hand, you have the optimistic view that, you know, poverty reduction and other forms of redistribution will become matters of domestic settlement as countries grow less poor. On the other hand, you have the secession of the successful.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Can you just shortly again explain the reasoning for the optimistic view? Because it's just a presumption, nothing else. But...
Time will tell. I think the reasoning is, well, could probably be another talk, but let's just say that a lot, that optimistic view presupposes quite a lot about the functioning of domestic political systems and the accountability mechanisms that exist, right? And that view is more optimistic than I would be about the effectiveness of those accountability mechanisms. Partly because it's not just about domestic political institutions. There's a variety of positive feedback loops that connect rising within country inequality with the next two challenges I'm going to describe, and in other words, they reflect and reinforce one another. The third challenge is what a now retired senior professional with the International Monetary Fund, at least as long ago as 2001, called fiscal termites. Great for a variety of processes that are nibbling away at the fiscal capacity of the state in the same way that termites will nibble away at your wooden house foundations if you live in a termite-infested part of the world. And there's a whole series of these, including profit shifting across borders within transnational corporate structures, the Amazon and Google having all their profits in Luxembourg phenomenon, shopping for residency, which I'll say a bit more about, and a variety of other avoidance schemes all limit the ability to implement rights regulation and redistribution. Now, financial market constraints aren't anything especially new. The then managing director of the International Monetary Fund warned more than 20 years ago that if a country's economic policies aren't deemed basically sound, the resulting capital flight can be, in his words, quite swift, brutal, and destabilizing. And Lena Mosley, who has written quite a lot about financial market pressures, has argued that those societies most in need of egalitarian redistribution may have, in terms of external financial market pressures, the most difficulty achieving it. Her argument has been, at least up until recently, that high-income countries can get away with a lot more in the eyes of the global bond market specifically than lower and middle income countries. Wolfgang Strieck and colleagues argue that that in fact is changing, but that's again another talk. What we do know is that some of the problems are growing more serious. This is a chart showing there is actually part of it that, for some reason, has vanished from the slide as it appears on the screen, but not from the slide as it appears over there. That's very curious. But you can see the most important lines here. This is health transnational corporations, and this is the effective tax rate that they have been paying from 1991 to 2016. These are technology corporations, steady downward trend. And no surprise here, these are the 10 multinationals worldwide with the largest offshore cash piles. In other words, these are cash reserves that they are holding outside their home country. And the estimate for the U.S. is that this is now about $2.5 trillion. As their effective tax rate has been plunging. This is before the latest tax break that Trump gave them, okay? So this is, you know, in terms of fiscal capacity, this is a real problem. Here's another real problem. These are Gabriel Zucman's estimates of the percentage of financial wealth held offshore for each of the world's regions and the loss of revenue to the annual loss of revenue to governments in that region. Okay, so a couple of individual countries here as well, Russia, Canada, USA. So offshore wealth in billions of US dollars, the share of financial wealth held offshore, and the annual tax revenue loss, okay? Now, the point here is that these things mean very different things depending on the region you're in. So, U.S. Is said here, other estimates, by the way, are higher. The U.S. is said here to be losing $36 billion a year in tax revenue because of people using tax havens. Well, that's a rounding error in the U.S. defense budget. On the other hand, in Africa, where 30% of financial wealth is held offshore, an annual revenue loss of $15 billion can mean quite a lot if, for example, you are a country that is genuinely trying to implement universal health coverage. This is a screenshot from the consulting firm that describes itself as the leader in residence and citizenship planning, which basically means helping extremely wealthy people buy the passports that will enable them to pay the lowest amount in taxes. Right? And there's increasing amount of media coverage about this. One of the most interesting books of the past few years was written by a sociologist named Brooke Harrington, who trained as a trust and estates planner, which is, you know, it's the basic qualification for helping the ultra-rich avoid taxes, and, you know, used that familiarity with the landscape to get some fascinating interviews with financial planners. And she found the financial planning industry to be remarkably diverse and meritocratic, but also argued that it has some fairly serious consequences, once again, for fiscal capacity. Because many countries are already more receptive and accessible to wealth managers than they are to elected representatives from their own governments. The high net worth individuals of the world are largely ungoverned and ungovernable. What this is doing to the Westphalian host system is similar in some respects to what e-commerce has done to bricks and mortar business, destroying it in a race to the bottom, right? Well, for those of us familiar with the decline of the British High Street, that image is especially evocative, right? You know, the argument here is that in the future, the state system and the fiscal capacity that underpins it is going to look a bit like the British High Street. Pretty sad. Challenge four is the normalization of austerity. And I would argue that the ideological template established by the structural adjustment programs of the 1980s and 1990s has now been normalized under the rubric of austerity. And as Alex Kentakellenis says in a recent paper, it's traveled north. It's threatening to become a permanent element of the policy terrain, despite the fact, the negative human consequences, which I'll go on to say a bit more about, And despite the fact that, as even some of the economists working for the IMF now acknowledge, it doesn't do what it says on the tin. It's not an effective catalyst for growth. This is Richard Horton, the editor of The Lancet, talking about austerity as the calling card of neoliberalism. Its effects follow an inverse harm law. The impact of increasing amounts of austerity varies inversely with the ability of community to protect themselves. Austerity is an implement of malice. What is promoted as fiscal discipline is a political choice that deepens the already open and bloody wounds of the poor and precarious. The task of health professionals is to resist and to oppose the egregious economics of our time. Right. That last line, statements like that last line are why I put that consumer warning at the start of the talk. Okay. Now, I really like this because this is not Jeremy Corbyn. I wish it were. This is Richard Horton. Just as I like that graph I showed you about corporate taxation, because it's not Jeremy Corbyn, it's the Financial Times. Well, why would Richard Horton say this? Okay, here are a couple of local illustrations. Again, these are quite parochial and will be familiar to most of you. This is the Institute of Fiscal Studies' most recent analysis of what fiscal changes between 2015 and 2022 are going to do to the incomes of people in the UK. And as you can see, change in annual net income, substantial, both numerically and as a percentage. We're talking about somewhere between 5% and 10% income loss at the bottom end of the income distribution, actually positive at the top. So austerity in the UK context is redistributing resources upward. These are Christina Beattie and Steve Fothergill's data on the relation between deprivation with the most deprived communities on the right and the annual loss to local economies of the fiscal tax and benefit changes that started in 2010 by the year 2021, and you can see there's a pretty consistent trend. The poorest areas suffering the most, with some deprived areas having more than £1,000 per working age adult per year sucked out of their economies by 2021. Right? And this is an annual figure, this is not a cumulative figure. Okay, so that's the normalization of austerity, you know, locally, although it's a worldwide phenomenon. And, you know, what we're seeing, you know, as you can see from these thermal images from The Guardian during the cold last winter in London, sleeping rough is becoming normalized. Food banks are becoming normalized. As my former colleague, Kayleigh Garthwaite, has pointed out in her award-winning book. Two other illustrations. Austerity is being normalized, right? This is our former Secretary of State for Health saying you should start saving for your care home when you're in your 20s. Don't expect the state to do it for you. The right-hand item is from the New York Times a few years ago about how in bankrupt Detroit, local businesswomen were having to resort to crowdfunding to get a backlog of rape kits tested, right? It's crowdfunding rape kit testing. This is the normalization of austerity. And in understanding it, vocabularies are key, and I'd really like to, if anyone is interested in collaborating on some research on this using critical discourse analysis or some similar technique, please get in touch with me. Just two terminological examples here, sustainability and resilience, right? And, you know, these are strategically important words because it's very hard to be against sustainability. It's very hard to argue that something should be unsustainable. it's very hard to be against resilience. But here in the global context, this is the World Bank on Sustainable Health Systems, which basically, it basically says they should be entirely self-financing, right? Including the incremental service costs associated with new investments and repayment of external debt, right? The bank these days, because of the support for universal health coverage, the bank is a bit more circumspect about this. This is a lovely image from post-Katrina New Orleans, which I hope you can read. It's a sign saying, "Stop calling me resilient," because every time you say, "Oh, they're resilient," that means you want to do something else to me. Spot on. Now, you'll see in about 90 seconds why I showed you this. I showed you the Beatty and Fothergill figures on fiscal measures and the drain on local economies, right? This is the cut in local authority budgets. These are the cuts that have already happened, and they're continuing, versus premature mortality in England. With a lot of scatter, the sickest areas are getting the largest local authority budget cuts. And keep in mind that these are the units of government that are now responsible for public health. This is a percentage cut in council spending power. Again, looking at what's already happened, not what's yet to come, versus rank on the index of multiple deprivation. In this case, the more deprived areas are on the left. A really remarkable correlation here. The more deprived the area, the bigger the local authority budget cut, right? And this is what Public Health England proposed to do about it in 2014, developing local solutions that draw on all the assets and resources of an area, integrating public services, and also building resilience in communities so they take control and rely less on external support. Right. This was quoted with a straight face by a researcher at a workshop on health inequalities that I attended a couple of months ago. But it's not just local. This is a worldwide phenomenon. This is Stiglitz's comment on structural adjustment and its sequelae. Lost quarter century of development in Latin America, in Africa, lost decade in Latin America, et cetera, et cetera. And according to the most recent analysis that Isabel Ortiz and colleagues have done, in the year 2020, 4 people out of 5 in developing countries are projected to be impacted by budget cuts. Right. Unfortunately, she hasn't updated the analysis since 2015, but I think it's unlikely to be much better. Most recently, the most conspicuous example is the constitutionalization of austerity in Brazil by way of a variety of mandated rollbacks in health and social protection, clear selection of austerity as an alternative to higher taxation. And there was multiple critiques by UN special rapporteurs on human rights of this measure that came out earlier this year. Right. This is pre-Bolsonaro, by the way. It's going to get worse. Okay, there are promising responses. There really are. This is from the pre-election manifesto of Ayanna Pressley, who is now the first African-American congresswoman in Massachusetts history, talking about using a very marmot-style image of how when you travel from a very wealthy area of the Boston-Cambridge area to a poor area, life expectancy declines by decades. The variation here is even larger than the one I showed you in Stockton. And she says, these are not naturally occurring, These are the legacy of decades of policies that have hardened systemic racism, increased income inequality, and advantaged the affluent. And this is a book co-edited by the former head of the Canadian Public Service. Obviously, he had to retire before he could put it out, but tax is not a four-letter word. I like these. You notice that neither of these comes from the UK. Right. So those are the four grand challenges. Here, very briefly, because I have talked more than I plan to, is the fifth, which is reconciling legitimate aspirations with biospheric constraints. I started my academic and my professional and academic life looking at environmental issues, and I now find myself drifting back to them, although I really should know better. This is a familiar graph by now. It simply shows you cumulative carbon emissions, cumulative carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere, still climbing, and temperature change. This is pretty familiar by now. We've all seen it. This is a composite NASA satellite photograph showing the parts of the world that are lit up at night and the parts of the world that are dark. It has to be a composite because it's not night all the way around the world at the same time. You'd be surprised how many students need that explained. And you can see that in terms of the lights that signal widespread access to electricity, Africa is still the dark continent, as indeed is a good portion of Latin America. But this is, you know, and this is, you know, this is the background against which climate has to be stabilized. 2.4 billion people who still rely on biomass for cooking and heating, and 1.5 billion people who have no access to electricity, right? So that's the equity dimension, or the equity substrate of addressing climate change. But climate change is only one of the many biospheric changes that are occurring simultaneously, driven by this process that Stefan and colleagues have described as the great acceleration in human activity and resulting biospheric impacts. And these are not, unfortunately, not reproduced very well, and I'm simply too lazy to cut and paste this into a dozen separate graphs. But the basic point here is that in most of these, the increase in human activity has occurred in the OECD and the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. And then at the top, there's a very thin band labeled as others, which includes, of course, Paul Collier's bottom billion. And keep in mind as well the context of extreme inequality within these countries, perhaps especially within the BRICS, the distribution of benefits from that increase in human activity is very, very uneven. Right. And these are the biospheric impacts of the great acceleration, or the biospheric manifestations. And the greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane, are only two of the expanding impacts. A variety of others, ocean acidification, nitrogen in the coastal zone. These are special concern to a colleague of mine with whom I've developed what I think is the first postgraduate taught module on global health in the Anthropocene. Anybody knows of another one, please let me know. Again, these are all accessible in Stefan's article, and the references for this presentation, along with most of the slides, will be up on the website. So if you're so inclined, you can check these out yourselves. This is all happening against the background, against a background we can describe with reference to the United Nations Human Development Index, which, as I'm sure you know, It's middle class consumption. Okay, so a minority, still a minority, of the world's population. This is all occurring against the background, which I'll describe in a moment with reference to the Human Development Index. So the Human Development Index was developed to illustrate the multidimensional nature of development, to provide an alternative to GDP or GNI. And it has a limited number of components, so it's still pretty crude. Life expectancy at birth, mean years of schooling, expected years of schooling, gross national income per capita on a log scale, so it minimizes the significance of GNI. They do vary, this is the core, HDI. UNDP does the number of variants. They do an equality-adjusted HDI. They do one adjusted for gender equality and so on, but this is the core. Now, there's another organization, not as well known, called the United Nations Environment Program, which is based in Nairobi, does very, very good work, which very few people pay attention to, perhaps because it's based in Nairobi. One of the things UNEP did a few years ago was quite a sophisticated analysis of countries' material footprints. That is to say, the total material throughput, including imports, less exports, that countries' economies generate. In other words, how much material throughput in tons it takes for that country to produce what it produces. Right. Now, these are much more sophisticated than the ecological footprint calculations that were coming out 2 decades ago. There is an even more sophisticated set that have very recently been published, and I'm still trying to figure out the methodology, but they look more sophisticated. The point here is simply this. Again, Norway's, you get the picture here. Norway, Switzerland, Australia consistently rank at the top of the HDI rankings, and South Sudan, Central African Republic, and Niger lowest. Okay. You probably knew that. What you're less likely to know is just how strongly high HDI reflects a high throughput of material resources. So you see the high HDI countries having very, very much larger material footprint, right? More than 20 tons per capita, despite some recent decoupling, than even the high HDI countries. These are the very high HDI countries. High HDI countries, that increase is largely accounted for by construction booms in India and China, which are very materials intensive. And, the lower HDI countries, of course, have fractional material footprint. Now, from an equity perspective, I would argue that the grandest challenge of all is how to get these countries whose residents can quite legitimately aspire to be up here where, quote-unquote, we are, up there without, completely catastrophic continuation of the Great Acceleration. There are a couple more dimensions to this. This is the environmental burden of disease as estimated by the World Health Organization and country gross national income per capita. And I'm happy to say that this is something we published in Journal of Public Health, much less happy that we couldn't get anyone to pay attention to it. But what you see here is essentially a perfect inverted Preston curve. This is the Preston curve flipped on its head. The richer a country, again, with a few conspicuous outliers, the lower its environmental burden of disease in terms of the number of people per 100,000 who are dying of environment-related causes, right? This is a poor country problem. Just two more illustrations of that point. This is the WHO map of PM2.5 concentrations in urban areas. And again, you see that urban air pollution and its health destructive consequences are a poor country problem. They're not a rich country problem. So as with the overall environmental burden of disease, there is a very clear growth dividend. And there's a growth dividend as well in terms of urban air pollution, with by far the world's most polluted cities being in poor countries, despite London. Okay, I have gone on a bit longer than I had intended to, but we still have lots of time for questions.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you so much. I mean, we did, and you wanted to talk for a little bit less, but I think it's been really fascinating and eye-opening. So we do have about 20 minutes for questions. Do you want me to select from the room?
Yeah, you can see better.
Yeah, if I'm standing up. So who would like to start? Yes, at the back.
Hi, yeah, my name's Mike Roberts. I'm also involved in the Shadow Team Support Network, and I'll come to Italy tonight because I was working for a certain well-known Shadow Chancellor, and I'm working on local government across the piece now. And I found the work of presentation very, very fascinating tonight. Some of the stuff I didn't know, some of the stuff I do know. The thing which I was going to raise was what the attitude internally is in relationship to people who should know better. In September 2017 at the Shard, at Warwick Business School, the ONS, the Office of National Statistics, said, quote, that they are working at a pace to look at all the British protectorates in relationship to where money goes. And if anybody believes that Gibraltar is all about the rock and the apes, it's got nothing to do with the rock and the apes. It's everything to do with where money goes. So they've now jumped out and said, you know, with a load of waffle, that there's nothing clarified at this particular point in time. So your analysis is very pertinent, it's very relevant. And in fact, for those of us in local government who are trying and struggling to actually keep the communities above collapse, I think it's also very relevant in relationship to the wider audience. And I hope that that can be drawn on and evaluated further. It's no use just doing the academic bit, but it needs to be got out much further because that's the sort of data that many of us have been crying out.
Thank you. I don't know if you want to speak to that or see if there are any other...
Well, I mean, this is... there is no original research in this presentation. There is some original theorizing. All the data are out there in the public domain.
I guess it's a question of who's using it,
yeah.
Where, and for what.
Yeah, but you've brought it all together, you know, and I very much welcome that.
Other questions?
So what can we do about it? I mean, what are your suggestions to address these things?
It depends entirely on sort of who you are, what... your work situation is, whether you have dependents who have to support, because there are political risks to this, and so on and so forth. I would say the biospheric stuff I essentially have no answer for, but I think it's disingenuous not to talk about it. Right. And, you know, that sense that it's disingenuous to talk about it was why I got out of doing environmental policy research, because at that point there was no receptiveness at all to such concerns. I would say the single most important message to get across in every policy context you can, is that public finance is a public health issue.
Yes, sir.
You just mentioned there are political risks. Could you maybe elaborate on for which particular strata that exists in particular?
Well, I mean, case in point, the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Ottawa, where I worked for many years, spent years trying to shut down the Institute of Population Health, which was a multidisciplinary unit where a number of us were making arguments like this. They eventually succeeded, although not until after I left U of O and left Canada. Clearly, you would, you know, my impression of people who work for Public Health England, at least many of the people I know who work for Public Health England, know all this stuff, but can't talk about it for predictable reasons. Right. In Scotland, it's a bit different. They talk about it. You know, some of the best work on social determinants of health and social policy comes out of the Glasgow Consortium on Population Health, but nobody does anything about it, right? if you're a student, at least in some of the regimes I'm familiar with, where you have no control and your supervisor has no control over who marks your dissertation, you can be in a situation that I describe as being analogous to having a dissertation on sexual harassment in the workplace being marked by Harvey Weinstein. Okay. Because there is simply a lot of hostility to this line of reasoning in medicine and the life sciences. I could go on, but I won't.
I mean, one of the points that you made, I think that might give some scope for thinking of action is really the framing of issues and how they've been conceptualized. So my takeaway, certainly in terms of what to do about it, on one, there's obviously mobilization and activity promoting certain agendas, but there's also challenging norms and challenging language that we hear, right? So this normalization of austerity, to call that out whenever it's made, to speak out and don't accept it, don't use those terms. And there is increasing recognition on various political circles about framing and discourse and how that plays to particular power structures.
Well, what can I say? I agree. I'm very keen on getting some collaborations going or supervising some theses that use some variant of critical discourse analysis, which is a pretty protean methodology, to look at patterns like the normalization of austerity. I wish I were more optimistic about the extent to which even supposedly progressive political leaders in this country are sensitive to the importance of constructing an alternative to the austerity narrative.
Do you think there's a generational shift in political leaders? I mean, certainly the U.S. is in the news a lot, but we see finally, at least, members of Congress coming from a younger generation, using different language, the progressive movement changing, as opposed to you critique Jeremy Corbyn before, who, you know, sits in a certain ideological position but comes out of a very old school way of thinking about these issues.
Yeah. I mean, clearly there is that kind of shift is underway in parts of the U.S., right? I think that the situation here is much more fluid, shall we say. And, you know, I say this as someone who, although I've been here for 5.5 years, is still very much an outside observer. My sense is that as class stratified as the U.S. society is, class stratification as it operates from a very early age here is a real barrier to the emergence of that kind of critical counter-narrative in a way that it wasn't when there was a major route to political upward mobility, if you will, that ran through the trade union movement. And Owen Jones's book, Chavs, is excellent on many points, but especially good on that point, right? And you don't have people with not a lot of formal qualifications now who have the route to political influence that ran through the trade union movement in previous generations. And I don't see an institutional formation emerging to replace the trade union movement here. I could be missing something. It happens all the time.
Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you for your presentation. I mean, one of the things that struck me as you outlined these grand challenges for public health, for global health, is sort of that you have an underlying critique of how we define global health. And studying global health, researching global health, we tend to think less about these transnational issues, and most of your examples did come from a lot of high-income countries. And just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the challenges about how we define global health politically or academically or from an activist perspective, and how that relates to how you see the challenges.
Sure. Well, I mean, you know, I've got examples from everywhere. I've got Tanzania, I've got Brazil, I've got the entire part of the world that is dark in those satellite images. But I do think there is a tendency to think of global health in terms of, you know, the health of those people in poorer countries far away, right? And, you know, that's a critically important enterprise, right? I would, as my measles slide might suggest, I don't want in any way to detract from the importance of that. But I think there is a need to think of global issues in terms of what William Robinson almost two decades ago called the shift from a territorial to a social cartography, right? So that we now have these world scale, literally world scale, differences in life expectancy in a small area in the north of England. We have we have these enclaves of extreme affluence, notably in resource-based economies, but not only there. I mean, Brazil, which is, you know, a country that had made some progress in reducing inequalities, is still on some measures economically the most unequal country in the world. Right. So, I mean, I don't want to make it sound as though, you know, the first and third worlds are becoming interchangeable. They're not, but the juxtapositions of wealth and deprivation are converging. I mean, that's, you know, that's, if you will, the other grand convergence.
Yes.
And following on from that, would you therefore argue for instance, a diminution or reduction in the aid budget, which is tied at the moment, you know, so increasing, to channeling some of that funds to national domestic policies?
Not really, because that buys into the Daily Mail narrative of our money going to those people out there when we should be solving our problems at home. And that can be very divisive. I would much rather see an aid budget substantially increased and better managed in parallel with you know, a new deal for the left behind areas of the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, it would not be terribly difficult to, in my view, building on the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development work to generate that policy blueprint, which makes it all the more surprising that it hasn't been done. And so far as I know, it hasn't.
I think that's more of an optimistic note. Perhaps new deals have been developed.
Yeah.
Welfare states have been established and changes have happened. So it gives us a way to look and think. I think we could probably wrap up now. Ted has to get a train back. So thank you so much for coming down and joining us.
Well, thank you for